Well, good morning, everybody. I want to thank Jim and Jeff and A5 for the opportunity to present this morning. I think it's a good, it'll be a good contrast. This work here was done in the Great Lakes region, which is certainly different than where the soil tilth lab is out in Ames. So it'll give you a little bit different look at some of the agro-ecosystems there. And what this talk, what we're going to be looking at is kind of under the assumption that growers are going to be selling Stover off of their farms, looking at some different scenarios that they might do that, and then looking at some of the environmental implications of each. And then looking at how growers can actually implement management practices to mitigate that carbon loss. We know we produce lots of crop residue, Stover, out there throughout all of the U.S., and those of us involved in agronomy, you know, we know that has value. Still, you don't have to go too far to find talks where you may have economists or someone else still referring to it as a waste. But certainly in this room, I think we all agree that it definitely is a resource and it has value to the grower. And what I'm going to do, some back of the envelope calculations. And when I talk about the carbon on the field, I'm going to have that in English units because that's primarily when we work with growers. That's how they visualize it and how they understand it. And then when I get into the greenhouse gas data, I'm going to then switch to metric units because basically that's kind of the convention for those. So I apologize in advance for some of the switching. But at least for me, it's more intuitive on the field level to look at carbon in terms of tons and acres. And when we do these back of the envelope calculations, we know in the Great Lakes region, for us, a good corn yield is 150 bushel. That's just with the limitations we have with the alfasol soils that we have up there. And if we have a harvest index of 0.5, that gets us about 7,140, or about 3.5 tons per acre of Stover when you dry that down. Field studies that have been conducted just with the mechanical equipment that we have up there, we have some limitations on how much we can pick up off the ground after you go through that with a combine harvester, and that's going to be at best about 70%. So our first scenario here for growers, if we take what they have available, 70% of it, they're going to be taking off about 2.5 tons per acre of Stover. So that's the one scenario. One of the other scenarios that we're looking at, and this is based on the development of bioprocessing technology, what we call consolidated bioprocessing. And we've made a lot of headway with that at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and I've got some preliminary data here that kind of shows that. And you can see if you look the first blue line, I'm sure I've got a pointer here or not, yep. This line here is in grams per gram of conversion, so it's basically a percent conversion of different harvest strategies for corn. This would be taking, this would be analogous to harvesting silage, green hull plant. You can see this, the pictures here try to depict kind of what we're trying to do here with the different systems. And if we process that directly from the field in time harvest right to the processor, we get about 0.26 grams per gram. This is the whole plant chopped up when it's at about two-thirds moisture level. And we have basically microbial fermentation cultures that handle both the starch and the cellulose together. And then you take that down to this. This is in gallons per acre here. That would equate to about 621 gallons per acre. The next strategy here, this was when we ferment. And surprisingly, there really no difference in the conversion here. And this was a real concern because if you go with just normal yeast, starch type yeast, they're inhibited by the lactic acid that's produced in the anaerobic fermentation process. But this particular culture that we obtained was not inhibited, and we got the same grams per gram yield after fermentation. And that's significant because when you look at some of the logistics of these systems, then growers could store this on farm, pack it, preserve it on a bunker silo on a cement slab, and that eliminates some of the issues with the materials handling at a cellulosic bioprocessing center. You wouldn't have to have, you know, a lot huge storage. You could then store it on farm and then sort of feed it to the plant as the plant needs it. And we do have a little bit of a reduction then on a per acre basis, because in this storage, you're going to lose about 5 to 8% of the dry matter during the process of that the anaerobic fermentation that takes place in that silage pile. And that's why this is a little bit lower than the fresh here. Then this is kind of, this would be the conventional way here, where you're kind of source separating the grain, the stover, and the cob. These were the yields you obtained. You can see when you take the low-hanging fruit, the starch out of it, you do get a good conversion here, but it does then deplete a little bit of the conversion for the stover and the cob portion, and then these are your respective yields. And then keep in mind, when you drop down here on a per area basis, you have to account for what you're going to leave behind in the field by your mechanical inability to pull up what's been run over by the combine. So that'll compare here, a total of 546. That's why that is a little bit less than what the 676 is with this whole plant harvest. This is where you would go through, basically it's the same thing as over here, but you leave it in the field until that grain matures. And you're harvesting it at, you know, this time of year, after you've black layered and it's field dried a little bit. You go through with basically the same equipment that you have over here, but you're going through probably 8 weeks later. You're harvesting the whole plant at the mature stage, again, running it through that consolidated bioprocessing, and then you have more starch in that feedstock because you've allowed that grain to mature, and you get a really good 0.29 grams per gram. So the reason I included this data in there is just to suggest that there probably will be opportunities for growers to remove the whole corn plant, which from a bioenergy standpoint is good, because then you're getting a lot of bioenergy on a per acre basis. But from a carbon standpoint, maybe not so good, especially on some of the more marginal type soils that we have in the Great Lakes region, because you're removing that resource and then selling it off farm. The other thing I need to point out with these different systems is here, you don't have the high quality dry distiller's grain that you're going to get with this system when you source separate it out. We do have groups working on the residuals of these, and we use ammonia fiber explosion as the pretreatment, adding nitrogen to that to kind of basically break up that matrix of the cell. We'll get the lignin and the hemicellulose, the pectin out. And some of the work shows if you keep some of that in that, what the residual you have left, it's a very good animal feed that you have coming off of this system as well. So we think there probably will be opportunities to market under this system, where you're taking the whole plant off, which again fits this talk because we're taking all the carbon off then. Okay, then the other thing I want to look at here then as well, in the Great Lakes region, theoretically then, to maintain soil organic matter where we're at, we're not trying to build it here, just to maintain it, how much stover could we theoretically remove? And again, the way we do this is kind of like our budget system, where we have our carbon inputs, and inputs are going to be our crop residue, both from the roots and the shoots. Some of the mitigation strategies, manure and compost, cover crops, or other organic waste, those would all be kind of on the input side of the ledger. Then on the carbon losses, and we really simplify this, we have our conversion costs. That's basically just what we have to feed the microbes in order to get them to convert our plant residue into soil organic matter. And then we just use a simple, about 1/6 of that you're going to have left over after we feed the microbes. Then we also have what we call our maintenance cost. We know that the existing soil organic matter pool is turning over. In our systems up there, that's going to be around 2.5% per year. So those are the carbon losses that we factor in. And again, with our typical alfasol soils and our acre furrow slice of 2 million pounds, 2.5% organic matter is very typical for soils that we have up there. That'd be about 50,000 pounds of soil organic matter per acre. And bear with me, we'll go through a couple calculations just to show you how we arrive at what we did. Then if you take what were basically this maintenance cost, 2.25 5%, we're losing about 1,250 pounds of soil organic matter every year just to that maintenance cost. Then if we convert that to crop residue, we need about 6,250 pounds of crop residue just to cover that maintenance cost, just to stay even here, which is our goal. So we know we need about 6,250 pounds per acre per year just to maintain our current organic matter levels, just to cover that decay factor. Then if you look at it, what you have on the positive side of the ledger, just again, some back of the envelope calculations here using existing data, and these are using book values here. We didn't dig up roots to find that out. That really wasn't what this study was about. But we come up with some averages here, about 1,100, 281 pounds for corn, and then the soybean crop would be about 4,450. So that rotation on average, a corn-soybean rotation, very typical for our area, would be about 7,800 pounds per acre per year of crop residue. Then we convert that those pounds of residue into soil organic matter. It's about 1,570 pounds that we're adding. And then just to kind of see where we are on our ledger then, we have the 7,865 annual average, but we need 6,250 of that. So we have about 1,600 pounds a year that we can work with. And if you take that all in the corn year then, you'd have about 3,200 pounds of stover that you could take off theoretically in the Great Lakes area and maintain soil organic matter. So it's about a ton and a half that we tell our growers that they can probably take off and maintain organic matter in this corn-soybean rotation. Okay, now to kind of summarize this for the different scenarios, we know that, you know, a grower might go out there with just his round baler and pull off 2.5 tons per acre. Or let's say he's gung-ho and he gets into this consolidated bioprocessing, he's taking everything off. He's taking off about the 3.5 tons or so, the 7,100 pounds that he has available. But to maintain soil organic matter, we know he should only be taking off about a ton and a half. So with this, these different scenarios out there, the two of them are really in excess of what he should be taking off. We know there's probably a need there to develop some mitigation factors that these growers can use to kind of up that carbon level so they're not in a situation where they're losing carbon. And this is just basically the statement, you know, we need to develop those management practices. So the first thing that we looked at, well, what about manure and compost? And we know the biology of animal manure decomposition is very similar to plant residue, with the exception it's been through one digestive process already because it's gone through the animal. Compost is going to be even a little bit more resilient because it's gone through two digestion processes, one through the animal and then again in the compost pile. So theoretically these should be very good carbon inputs. What about cover crops? We've done some work with cover crops in the state, and again, we know that this decomposition is going to be very similar to plant residue. The carbon to nitrogen ratio is going to be a little bit lower. It's green material, whereas your carbon stover ratio is going to be a little bit higher because it's more mature. But nonetheless, it is carbon that we're adding. And we know that we can, in a corn-soybean rotation, we can get average about a ton or so by planting a winter cereal like rye following corn and soybeans. And some of the systems that we look at are really amenable to that. With the soybean, we can get about 2.5 tons of rye the next spring. And with the corn, if we let it go all the way to grain, it's going to be on the lower end of that because we've run out of growing season by the time we harvest that. But it is a system that offers some it offers some mitigative properties to the grower over time. So now I'm gonna show you some results from a 3-year study where we did some of the global warming potential greenhouse gas production work, working with this was a corn-soybean-corn rotation. And I want to stress that this was short-term because, you know, we understand, I like the analogy you made to carbon pushing an elephant. Getting it to move up or down, I guess, is like pushing an elephant. It moves slow. But this was kind of a short-term snapshot look at what was going on in the field with these different systems. And we kind of on the, we actually removed all the corn stover in this study. So this was simulating that consolidated bioprocessing system where the grower goes through and removes all of the above ground part of the plant. And it was a corn, soybean, corn sequence. The experimental design randomized complete block, it was a two-factor factorial, the first factor being cover crop present, either yes or no, and then the third one was the carbon amendments. We have we had manure, compost, or neither. We used no-till practices in this for all of the crops and the cover crops, and the treatments then consisted of the winter rye cover crop alone or in combination with either the manure or the compost, and then the same true with, you know, the compost and manure either alone or with the rye, and then an untreated check. The manure that we used was solid beef manure from the Michigan State University bee farm that had sawdust as the bedding material, and it was very high in carbon. Probably if you took average manure values, it probably would have been a little bit higher in carbon because of the heavy use of the sawdust there. And then the dairy manure, the composted manure, was from the MSU dairy farm, and they were applied both in the spring and the fall. And we based the application rates on the available plant nitrogen. And again, remember, and I'll show you some of the data later on that'll explain some of our findings, the high sawdust level in the beef bedding, we had to put a lot of it on the field, which gave us a lot of carbon, which was good, in order to get the recommended nitrogen rate. Then on the plots that didn't receive our manure or compost, we used a preseason nitrate test to determine the amount of urea ammonium nitrate that was applied to those plots. And we measured gas flux, both methane and nitrous oxide, from the soil in with a static chamber approach. The global warming potential values for the agronomic inputs, all the herbicides, all the chemical, the seed, everything we got from either the Weston Marlin paper or from the International Panel on Climate Control. And those values, we tried to cover everything. We have the fuel used, the chemical and fertilizer, transportation of the seed. For the manure, we figured 47 kilograms per head per year of the methane, just from the enteric fermentation, the burping, the belching, whatever. And then also we had 118 kilograms per head per year loss from the manure before it was compost is what we figured. And then consistent with local farming practice, we also added in a 90-day manure storage and took the nitrous oxide and methane emissions off from that as well and put those into the calculations. But the CO2 emissions from the manure, we do not count in the assessment because the CO2 that's emitted from the manure was originally in the atmosphere to start with since it's autotrophically derived. Then the bottom calculation there shows the net global warming potential for each cropping system was we took the change in the soil carbon, GWP, added the nitrous oxide and methane fluxes, added the input flux, and that gave us our net GWP for each system. Results, first to show you some of the yields that we got from the cropping systems with the different treatments. And the reason I wanted to throw this in there was to show that we did a pretty good job in balancing the nitrogen application rates between the manure, the compost, and the synthetic fertilizer. We didn't have differences in 2002 and 2003. And the manure treatment in 2004 was a little bit lower. It was significantly lower than the highest treatment there of the rye and compost. And again, we probably, because of all the carbon in there from the sawdust in that in the manure bedding, we probably underestimated the plant available nitrogen that 1 year. If we look at the net GWP, and you can see the different columns here, The first is the change in the soil carbon GWP over those 3 years. So again, very short term. Then what our flux was for that duration. And then, this is annualized over the 3 years. And then what the methane flux, then what the input flux was. And this is in grams of CO2 per meter squared per year. And then we come up with a net global warming potential. And in the world of GWPs, if you're not familiar with it, a negative number is where you want to be, because a negative one means you're pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it into the soil. So you can see with the compost treatment, we had a negative 1,811 grams of CO2 per meter squared per year, also negative with the manure. Our untreated was just slightly positive. And then this is our LSD. And then we did not see, keep in mind this is a factorial, we didn't have a significant interaction. So the cover crop treatments are averaged across the manure. So they come out negative, but the difference between the untreated and the cover crop is not significant. And that is likely due to the short duration of the study. And I'll show you another slide that kind of explains that also. So we were really encouraged by these results. They show that, with management practices, you can take these cropping systems to where they're really carbon sequestering, even though you're taking off all of that carbon for bioenergy. This I threw in to kind of explain why the cover crops didn't do so well relative to the others. If you look at the total in megagrams per hectare that we were putting on in terms of carbon, we're only, we're at a ton or a couple ton with a cover crop versus with the manure and the rye and the compost, you're in, eight, a little bit lower. This year we had a little bit hotter manure. But the totals over the time, you have about 5 ton compared to over 20 ton for the systems that actually receive the manure and carbon. So really, this type of work would need to be carried on longer to see what kind of contribution you're going to get from that cover crop over a longer period of time. One of the things that we like to do when looking at these systems, you also really should be, if you're going to do a whole cost accounting, take into consideration the amount of gasoline that you're displacing with that cropping system. And that's what we tried to do here. If you look at the green bars here, this is the contribution that you're getting from the cropping system itself. They're negative, you can see. But if you displace this much carbon, would be displaced by an equivalent amount of gasoline that you're taking off. And we figure about 0.7 gallons for every gallon of ethanol produced. So really, it really underscores the environmental benefit of bioenergy versus petrochemical fuels. The other thing that's kind of interesting, if you can put a cost or a price on that carbon as well, and that's what we did here. This would be the carbon cost per acre, and you can see the growers of these systems with the compost and the manure. If you valued carbon at the rate that it currently is on the European carbon exchange, it would have a value of $150, $90 here. You get an additional benefit from the carbon you're displacing by not burning gasoline. You're burning by producing the bioenergy. You can see what just the carbon cost increase is in terms of societal benefits from these cropping systems. So in conclusion, the numbers are there. With just a corn grain stover bioenergy cropping system, about 120 kilograms per hectare, 1,800 kilograms per hectare with the compost, 10,000 with the manure system. And this is, you can compare that with a switchgrass system here of about 6,615. This is without any mitigation. This is from the Schmer paper. And an equivalent amount of gasoline, you'd actually be emitting this much, which further substantiates the benefits of those. And there's certainly other issues involved with these that I'm not going to talk about, but just to remind me there that you also should be looking at the runoff aspects. The previous speaker mentioned the dollar value as well of the nutrients within that stover. But again, this was just looking at the carbon. So with that.
We have about 3 minutes for questions. So if you have a question from the audience, yes, sir.
Can I ask two questions? Have you, and for the cover crops, have you looked at legumes like hairy vetch or something? I know the LTER at KBS mm-hmm. has used that as a cover crop in the past.
Yeah, we're looking at legumes and mixtures of cropping systems. This particular study we did not, but it is something that we're looking at in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and hopefully we'll be able to pick up some of the value from the nitrate in that in terms of global warming potential.
Second question, not more of a comment. I think in calculating your GWP, where you've got manure and compost additions, I would say that you can't really, you can't just straight off count the carbon increase where you're applying the manure and the compost, because you're bringing in carbon from outside your system boundaries. So I don't think it's really legitimate to count that straight off as if there's no burden on bringing that carbon in. In other words, if you're gonna do that analysis, I think you need to look at within a total system boundary, accounting for the greenhouse gas implications of where the manure is produced from, if you follow that.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the change in the soil, the manure is applied to the soil, and we're actually measuring then the change in carbon in the soil.
Sure.
So that's
sure.
undergoing the
right.
losses as that naturally
right.
occur. And then we did calculate in, we had the benefit of having manure right on campus from our farms, if that's what you're getting at. So that transportation cost was factored in, which is going to be low because it's close.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of the transportation. I'm just thinking of the issue of an external carbon import to your system that you're not sort of, that's coming in from outside the boundary of the system that you're doing your life cycle assessment on. It's kind of an unbalanced.
Yeah, and it's kind of the assumption that it's all autotrophically derived, but you have other inputs into that livestock system that are actually carbon costs. So I understand what you're saying.
Okay, time for one more question.
Greg?
How did you account for roots in your carbon budget?
The roots in those, what I call our back of the envelope calculations on the front end of the part where we're just looking at what we have available, we just took book values. The other, in the actual field measurements, the roots would all, that would be accounted for in the change in soil carbon from the start to the end.
Okay, thank you very much. That was a very good presentation. Our next presentation is by Ziying Hao from Beijing, China. She will be speaking on distiller grain being fed to livestock.
Ready to proceed?